when Russian forces are holding some territory, some Ukraine was able to take back, but a lot of it Russia is holding. So that's the reality on the ground he's been talking about. So yes, he always gives the signals, as long as you're able to negotiate on my terms, I am willing. And as for the prisoner exchange, yes, it was for a while that hasn't been going on, but actually in this particular part of the war, because we already had 2014 when Russia annexed Crimea and there was some military action, this time the prisoner exchange actually has been going infinitely better. In fact, they were really trying on that front to keep with the war with the war rules.
And Professor Kusheva, if you could say more about the prisoner of war exchange, how important it is, because there apparently, I don't know how much is known about how many Russian prisoners of war are in Ukraine, but there are reportedly thousands, over 4,000 Ukrainian soldiers still in Russian captivity. And then also, if you could say, what is the position of the Russian military now? There are some reports that suggest that a large number of the fighting forces, pre-war, pre-invasion fighting forces, have been wounded or killed. And now the main people who are fighting in Ukraine are former convicts and people who've been drafted who aren't very well trained. Is that correct?
Well, not entirely. Thank you. Not entirely correct. We don't know how many thousands on each side actually they're prisoners. And of course, there's always prisoner exchange. I mean, I just want to warn, I'm not a war expert, but what I'm seeing, prisoner exchange is always some sort of in many ways, always political manipulation. You give some, you take some. This is the largest one. Apparently, what I'm reading that I think it was 245, and 75 of them was not even negotiated. Somehow the Ukrainians just gave them back. And this is for a number of prisoners from the Azov Battalion. You may remember there was this very famous Azov Battalion associated with the hard nationalist Ukrainian force, and there was a lot of arguments whether they should go free or not. And so apparently some of these people have been released from the Russian side. So this is the this is what we are hearing. Also, there've been in December there was a lot of talk that the new year is coming and it's important, and so we really have to have a good faith. As for those who fight in Ukraine, of course, I mean there's a tremendous amount of casualties. We don't know once again how many, but tremendous amount. But what Russia figured out, what the Kremlin actually sort of figured out somehow, is that it's not the conscripts, but and so these are people who voluntarily fight. And many of those who come in voluntarily fighting, they did have some military training. And then there is this Prigozhin we spoke about, I think, in the summer. During the Prigozhin coup, Evgeny Prigozhin, the Wagner chief, who was first pardoned and then killed for his mutiny in June, he was the one who came up with that system that the prisoners, violent prisoners, go and fight, and that's how they become regular citizens, so to speak. So a lot of them are in the army. They do go through some training. Russians, regular Russians, are very unhappy about that because a lot of these people come back and then commit violent crimes. But at the same time, it allows regular people also not to go and fight. And that's how kind of Putin has been able to keep the semblance of sort of normalcy of the country at war, but not really the country at war.
And Professor Kusheva, if you could talk about what conditions are like within Russia in terms of both how the war is being perceived there, what ultimately the effect of the sanctions has been, what evidence you see of the effects of those sanctions today in Russia, and the fact that the majority of people there, according to polls, do not support the war. And yet Putin has over 80% approval rating still. And speak specifically, actually, in one of your pieces, you talked about this rural-urban divide, how the war is viewed in St. Petersburg and Moscow as opposed to elsewhere in the country. If you could if you could talk about that.
Exactly. I mean, and that's really a tale of two Russias. In the cities, people try to stay away, pretend it doesn't happen, despite all the billboards and kind of volunteer places where you can go and sign up. And in the piece that you mentioned, you go into a bookstore and all those people who are foreign agents, the one that been branded as foreign agents because they have not been supporting the war, the writers, their books are available. You know, all the sanctioned chips and Mars bars or something, all of this is available. So you kind of wouldn't even know that there is war. And then you go deeper into cities in Siberia. I was in Omsk, which is not very deep in Siberia, but far enough. And there, in the little villages, there are beauty salons all of a sudden just popping up because the widows or those who are women who send their sons and husbands to war got a lot of money. I mean, it's actually something that's how the army now functions. People are being paid off. And these were poor regions. And now suddenly they're washing off in money. They can go to on vacation. They can have some summer trips to warmer places and so on. And so this is kind of the dividing. I mean, Russia has, I mean, the double eagle is its coat of arms. It's always had this split personality disorder, the schizophrenia. But now it's visible more than ever in the cities. People pretend it's far away because they cannot stop it. But in smaller towns, in fact, they people are for Putin. They're not for the war, but they are for, so, well, let's show the West that we are not going to surrender and whatnot. And also, I want to say that 80% is not a regular figure, but I would say that 60% is the support. And 56% want the war, want negotiations now because they feel that Russia for 2 years withstood the sanctions, figured it out how to move on because sanctions are not that visible except for the inflation and prices. But other than that, they just feel that now Russia can end the war on stronger terms.
So we just have about a minute, but the title of your piece, The West Must Face Reality in Ukraine, if you can talk about what that is, what we're not understanding, particularly in the United States, and how this leads into the elections in March.
Elections in March, I mean, when Putin is going to become president again. Yes, we don't call it elections, of course. It's that, you know, Joe Biden declared that he's going to strategically defeat Putin because he cannot withstand the war. That has proven otherwise. In the piece, I call it the Stalingrad effect, when the whole world is on Russia, is want to take Russia down. Russia sort of figures out how to do these things. And so the quick victory, as Biden promised, over Russia is not going to happen. I actually really don't see how Russia can be defeated in this war. It's a country of 11 time zones. And so I suggest that one day there has to be some sort of scaling back this grand idea of defeating Russia and figuring out how to actually end this war in the Ukraine. And then go on punishing Russia if you want. But the war should really not be part of that strategic agenda for the United States.
Nina Khrushcheva, we thank you so much for being with us. Professor of International Affairs at the New School, speaking to us from Moscow. We'll link to your piece for Project Syndicate, The West Must Face Reality in Ukraine. Next up, we speak with civil rights leader Bishop William Barber, who's calling for more awareness and justice for disabled people after he was kicked out of a North Carolina movie theater when he went to see The Color Purple with his 90-year-old mother. Why did the AMC call the police when he put out his special chair to accommodate his disability? Stay with us.
God is inside me and everyone else. That was or ever will be. I came into this world with God, and when I finally looked inside, close as my breath is to me.
The cast of the new musical adaptation of The Color Purple singing the theme song. The movie based on Alice Walker's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. She was the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. We end today's show with civil rights leader Bishop William Barber, who's calling for more awareness and justice for disabled people following his ouster from Greenville, North Carolina movie on Christmas week. He said AMC staff confronted him over his use of a specialized chair he carries with him and needs to use due to an arthritic condition he's had for decades. The Reverend was attending a screening, the premiere of The Color Purple, with his 90-year-old mother the day after Christmas. The new musical adaptation of Alice Walker's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel had the second biggest Christmas Day opening of all time. Some of the original 1985 film was shot in North Carolina. The new film features the North Carolina actor Fantasia Barrino-Taylor as Celie, reprising the role she played on Broadway. Bishop Barber says the staff refused to allow him to use his chair in the theater's disabled section. Instead, they called the police to have him removed. Two officers arrived, escorted him out of the movie theater as the trailers played. Bishop Barber shared with us a video of the incident. This is a part of it.
I'm going to take you out.
I cannot go out.
Okay, I'm going to tell you. And I'm going to take you out, and I'll charge you on my car. That's fine.
If you want to take me out and leave the property, then I'll do that.
Yep, that's what I
want to
do.
I do it all the time.
He's been on Broadway.
I do it all the time. I've been on Broadway.
Broadway.
Come on. Y'all.
At the White House.
I've been on Broadway.
At the White House.
I've been in the White House with this chair.
Yeah,
they've called an officer of the law.
So that was Bishop Barber being escorted out of the theater last Tuesday, the day after Christmas. He says his removal was a violation of the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act. AMC Theater released a statement that the company apologized to Barber and his family, and AMC chairman and CEO Adam Aron met with Barber this week. We'll ask him about that meeting in a minute, but first I want to turn to Bishop Barber's press conference from Friday, when he shared with the world what happened to him when he took his 90-year-old mother to see The Color Purple.
This week was going to be our time of reminiscing, knowing, Bishop Blow, that this would be a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. You know, a movie doesn't stay in the theater forever.
That's right.
It has a season, and then other movies come along. It won't be in the theater next Christmas. Right? This was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. The original plan was to see the movie on Christmas Day. But then we chose the matinee, and truthfully, I knew it would be so many people there, and I know, you know, she's slower now, I'm slow, so I asked her, would she mind doing matinee? Not in the evening when most people come, but 1 o'clock, you know, 2 o'clock in the day, 3 o'clock. On Saturday, this coming Saturday, we're having a major celebration of her birthday, even though she was born in November. And on Saturday, in Piney Woods, a place most of you in the media may or may not know about, it's one of the few free communities, the communities that was always with free black folk, mulatto, black, and Native Americans in eastern North Carolina. And on that day, we're going to sing, and she said she wanted anybody in the community to come free. Free food, free music, and the governor has decided to give her the Order of the Longleaf Pine for her years of service in this state. So this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. This week was planned out. See the movie this week, this time, enjoy the reminiscing, and then on Saturday to have this big gathering at home, outside, under tent, we have the tissue. And then I had to get back on the road because I've got to preach on Sunday evening for a national watch night service in Winston-Salem. Excuse me. But our plans were interrupted when the managers of the AMC Theater here in Greenville chose to call the police rather than accommodate my visible disability. For more than 30 years now, I've suffered from a form of arthritis that's a rare, but one of the most dangerous forms, debilitating form, called ankylosing spondylitis. Most of you in here, I've never talked to you about it. All you just see me doing is pushing on through. I walk now with two canes. I have to carry a high chair with me everywhere I go because my hip is fused, part of my neck and spine, and I cannot bend to sit in a low chair nor rise from a low position.
For more, we are joined by Bishop Barber. He's joining us today from Indianapolis, Indiana, because he always is on the road. President and senior lecturer at Repairers of the Breach, founding director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. Bishop Barber, welcome back to Democracy Now! Under these terrible circumstances and always. You just met with the head of AMC, the largest movie chain in the world. Can you talk more about what happened? Here you're about to celebrate your mother's 90th birthday, and the managers come and call the armed police and security guard to haul you out because you've got a chair you've sat in everywhere from the White House to a prison cell to accommodate your disability?
Yes, Amy, you know, it's quite absurd and tragic, not just for me, but what continues to happen to persons with disability. You know, the ADA came about because people refused to move and were arrested, and all kinds of things happened to them. Three officers, one security guard, and two police with guns. And the police actually treated me better than the managers. And I'm not ashamed of having a disability. In the Bible, Moses had a disability, Paul had a disability, Jesus was acquainted with sorrow. Down through history, God has used a lot of people with disabilities, from Fanny Crosby, who was blind but wrote hymns, and Isaac Watts, who wrote Joy to the World but had pain all of his life, Roosevelt, who had polio, and Wilma Rudolph, who had polio, and John Kennedy, who was ailing, Fannie Lou Hamer. The list goes on and on. But I'm ashamed of going to a place in my own hometown and basically being stopped at the door and being told that my chair, not where I placed it. In fact, I've been in the same theaters before, as you said, noted, from the Vatican to the White House to prisons with this chair. But the chair was not going to be allowed because it was a fire hazard when it's not where you place it. I always choose theaters that have the handicap cutout areas, where you put wheelchairs or any other. But it's a specially cutout area where they put no other chairs there. And they're being told by the persons, well, go get a doctor's note and come back. As though getting a doctor's note, if it was a violation of a hazard, why would a doctor's note change that? Or being told, we know who you are, but you're still not going to come in here with this chair. And then for them to call the police, and because I debated them and I had my right to challenge them, that there was this loud, boisterous, big black man, I guess, and that I was trespassing, and they wanted me arrested for trespassing. And then when the officers came to suggest that to move me or to arrest me, they'd have to empty the theater, which is why I went on and went out, because I wasn't going to disrupt everybody else's day. But I think about all the other people in the world, people who don't get up and try to enjoy public accommodation because of their fear. And the law says you have to reasonably accommodate. You have to try to accommodate. There was no attempt to accommodate. There was attempt to say no, period, end of story. you're not coming in. And in my hometown, it's of all the things we have to be fighting at this time, war, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, homophobia, a fight for voting rights, to fight for living wages, to fight for health care, that these two managers would choose to fight me, to fight somebody who has a visible disability and say no to me going in and watching a movie that's about triumph and family, which is why my mother really wanted to see it on that day. She's 90. I don't know how much longer she'll be with me, with us. But, you know, and her question was simply this, and with tears, why? And, you know, she fought for openness and fought for civil rights. Why is it that two persons, and it doesn't matter what color they are, you know, we were even told, well, you should have called in advance. First of all, the law does not say that. You don't have to call in advance. But the fact of the matter is we did. We had purchased seats in advance and made sure that there was a handicapped cutout area. And yet we were treated like this. It's quite absurd, quite tragic. And that's why we have to fight. And it's not about me. It's about the millions and millions of people, some who never come out because they're afraid something like this might happen to them.
Bishop Barber, if you could give us a little history lesson on the American Disabilities Act, its origins, and what it's made possible for people across the country.
Well, you know, it actually tracks the Civil Rights Act of 64. You know, it flows out of that same legal theory, equal protection under the law. And it was bipartisan. Senator Tom Harkins actually introduced it. And interestingly, George Bush Sr. signed it in the 1990s. And basically, you know, people had to sit down in restaurants, had to refuse to move. They had to bring their whatever they used to be mobile, whatever they used to be accommodated. And they were arrested and sometimes beaten and kicked out and spit on, all kinds of things. But they refused to give up. They basically said, we are not going to be denied. And what the law says is a public business, and theaters are included in that, you know, anything that's public, you have to accommodate reasonably people. You cannot keep them from enjoying what the rest of the public enjoys simply because they have some form of a disability. You know, and there have been some tragic stories. Some years ago, a young man with Down syndrome was actually arrested and killed at a theater. He was asphyxiated and suffocated, all because people did not want to recognize his disability and treat him fairly.
Bishop Barber, why did you decide to leave with the police? Can you talk about what they threatened to do this day, the holiday? I mean, Color Purple, Bloom, other movies, Out of the Waters, opened on Christmas Day, was filmed where you were in North Carolina, in the state of North Carolina. They were going to clear out the theater if you insisted on staying?
Exactly. The managers were insisting that. Now, you know, Sister Oprah did a tremendous with this job through this movie Fantasia. You know, Oprah, I've served on panels and that she's convened. But yes, the police, see, the manager said we wanted, they said trespassing. And the police had to get involved because they made that call and made that accusation.
They're going to charge you with trespassing?
Charging with trespassing. Is that after I paid to be there? And they said that because I debated them, they described debating. And sure, I debate strong and hard when you're trying to take rights. I mean, that's what I do. And so if you are upset or angry or bothered, then somehow that's what made them so bothered that they wanted me out. They wanted me arrested for trespass. Now, the police literally kind of let me know they didn't even want to be there. But what they said is, if you don't leave, we're being told we have to clear this theater in order to arrest you. So I said, I cannot leave in good conscience. If you take me out, I'll go with you. I'm not going to resist arrest or risk. But you can, what the police did when they got me out, they left. They didn't even try to stay. They said, okay, fine, we don't really want to be here. Now, we were sitting on the outside, and a TV news station came, and we were talking to them. This manager came out with another security guard with a gun, saying we had to leave. I couldn't even stay and wait on my mother to come out. I had to leave her in the theater with an attendant. and a young girl who also has a disability. She has had epilepsy, and her mother, they wouldn't let me stay there. And then when we were leaving, the lady waved like a taunting wave, as though she had won.
Bishop Barber, you met with the AMC CEO, Adam Aaron. He came to Greenville to meet with you. What were your demands of him?
Well, I can't say everything, but I can tell you we did not come to a resolution. We had a beginning conversation, and we agreed that some things need to be changed. He gave an apology, but as I said, apology is about action, because this is not about me personally. It's about me, but it's about bigger than me, because if you would touch me, who else will you touch? Who else will be affected negatively? We agreed to a second meeting. Hopefully, we can really get down to the kinds of solution that needs to happen that could be quantified and concretized and measured. This is very serious business. It's very serious business. It is about the law. It is about our fundamental rights. I was glad that he came. I'm somewhat encouraged by him coming, but that was the initial conversation. And while I agreed to confidentiality, you know, even my sense is that he received some distorted facts that I had to correct him. For instance, one of the things is very, very clear. When I finally went into the theater, I was stopped. They weren't even going to let me go in the theater to even access where I could sit or what could be accommodated. When I finally went in, I deliberately chose what I've chosen hundreds of other times, a cutout area that says handicap, that's designed for a chair, wheelchair, and was in a position to make sure that wasn't bothering anybody, wasn't in the aisle. I have sense enough to know you can't sit something in the aisle. But I sat that chair where I've sat it at Broadway and other theaters. And it was when I got inside that then they brought the police. So part of the day, the other day, was clarifying for him, really clear, because, you know, his people have talked to him and distorted the record. But we've got hopefully another conversation, and we'll see after that one, you know, where we are on this. But we cannot let this go, because it's too important to too many people. As I say, I think about the people who just every day say, I would go, yeah, but I'll just stay home. I'll just stay home.
Reverend Barber, we just have a second, but if you could talk about how you've used your own experience, your own health issues, to draw attention to the lack of adequate health care for a lot of Americans.
Well, you know, you have a certain empathy when you have it. I think every day I have health care, but what about people suffering from ankylosing that don't? 87 million people in this country are either uninsured or underinsured. You know, I have some resources to even buy a chair or to see the doctor. But what about the more than 100 plus million people who are poor and low wealth? You know, poverty is the fourth leading cause of death right now in this country. What about persons like that don't have an opportunity? I think your pain in life is supposed to make you more committed to standing with others, to serving with others, and to challenging systems of injustice. That pain should bring a certain empathy, a certain sympathy, and a certain kind of courage. You know, any time, any day, I want to quit or just stop. I look at people who are even in worse situations than me, and I say, you know, you cannot stop simply because you have a challenge. And the fact of the matter is, historically, some of the people with the greatest challenges, you know, one of our greatest presidents in this country had polio. Today, he probably couldn't get elected because people would be more focused on his chair than his heart and his mind. And that's tragic. You know, one of our greatest civil rights leaders, Fannie Lou Hamer. Some people today wouldn't want her because she had a serious disability and polio. But thank God that she turned her pain into some kind of power. It didn't mean it didn't hurt. It wasn't frustrating.
Bishop Barber, we have to break now, but we're going to continue our discussion with you. And I just want to ask, did you ever get to see The Color Purple?
No.
Bishop William Barber, President and Senior Lecturer at Repairers of the Breach, Founding Director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. In our post show at democracynow.org, we're going to ask you about your piece, Evangelical Appeal to Moral Case for Ceasefire in Gaza. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week, I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, and we wish you the best for the new year.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM.